Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Freeforum, a world that just might work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Sheila Kuehl, California legislator for 12 years, LA County supervisor for 8, and out of office now for a little more than 3 months. And you are welcome to go back and learn about her career, which is quite impressive. On Freeforum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at provocative, new, helpful areas of politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn.com. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. I hope anyone who listens to the show on a regular basis believes that I mean it when I say that it's about a world that just might work. And I'd rather it be identified that way than as a political or an environmental or a progressive show, although all of those things end up happening on the show. I just want these conversations to be a search for a world and a society that works for all of us. Now, there are many who probably believe, and with pretty good reason, that it is hard to find true public servants in politics or in elective office. Well, I must say that owing a great deal to where I have lived for the past several decades, that I've been represented by a number of them. And today's guest, Sheila Kuehl, was my California Assembly member and state senator, and later my LA County supervisor. And of all the guests I've had on the show since 1996, when I began doing it, crazy as that is, I've perhaps not been aware of someone for as long as today's guest. As a young teenager growing up in Florida before it went completely mad, my favorite television show was The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis. And I looked it up. It ran from 1959 to 1963. So those are the years when I was 11 to 15. And Dobie Gillis was the launching pad for a number of careers. Tuesday Weld played Dobie's crush, Thalia Menninger. Warren Beatty played wealthy BMOC Milton Armitage III. Beatty notwithstanding, one could argue that no one from that cast has had a more successful post-Dobie Gillis career than Kuehl. First elected in 1994, Sheila Kuehl served 8 years in the California State Senate, 6 years in the State Assembly. In 2008, she left the legislature due to term limits, and she later served as LA County Supervisor from 2014 till this past December. And in the years from 2008 to 2014, while she was out of office, she was one of my go-to sages for state and county politics and elections on my radio show on KPFK. So I got in touch with her recently, letting her know I'd love the chance to speak again to get her reflections on her time in public service, as well as her thoughts on our present situation and where we might go from here. By the way, in our 2010 pre-election show, we were talking about Governor Jerry Brown, Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, and Attorney General Kamala Harris. So a lot has happened in the last dozen years. And because our conversation is going to include reflections from Sheila on her long career, I'll just offer a few headlines and let her fill in the blanks as we speak. A child actress whose career high point was her role on Dobie Gillis, Kuehl attended UCLA and then Harvard Law School. She's the first openly gay or lesbian person to be elected to the California legislature. During the 1997 to 98 legislative session, she was the first woman in California history to be named Speaker Pro Tem of the Assembly. While in the state legislature, and I'm going to go through a number of the issues and bills she did, so we don't have to hit those details necessarily, but she authored 171 bills that were signed into law, including legislation to establish paid family leave, establish the rights contained in Roe v. Wade in California statute, overhaul California's child support service system, establish nurse-to-patient ratios in every hospital, require that housing developments of more than 500 units have identified sources of water, prohibit discrimination on the basis of gender and disability in the workplace and sexual orientation in education, increase the rights of crime victims, safeguard the environment and drinking water, and many, many others. She was repeatedly voted the smartest member of the California legislature. In 2006 and again in 2008, she brought SB 840, the California Universal Healthcare Act, to the governor's desk. The first time in history a single-payer healthcare bill had gone that far, and it was vetoed both times. Elected to the LA County Board of Supervisors in 2014, she served as chair of the Board of Commissioners of First Five LA, first vice chair of the Board of Directors of LA Metro, and on the board of the new Community Choice Aggregation, CCA, known as the Clean Power Alliance. And I will want you, Sheila, to tell us about First Five LA and the Clean Power Alliance for those who don't know. She helped earmark hundreds of millions of dollars to transition the county away from jails, champion Measure W, which created a tax to help pay for projects that conserve stormwater, helped push through an ordinance to curb the use of single-use plastics in the county. That's a lot. So a lot of good things that have happened over the last, now it's 30-ish years, at some point felt the touch or the push of Sheila Kuehl. Welcome, Sheila Kuehl, to Freeform, a world that just might work.
Thank you, Terrence. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Very good. And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, March 28th. So I like always listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. Well, having left the public stage, at least for now, at 81, can you tell us a bit about, I mean, you can go longer than we usually do, but how you see your path? And feel free to go way back, mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision. How did this young, smart 8-year-old actors who got a job on TV end up having the career you've had?
Well, you know, there are a lot of doors that open and you don't always know which way to go. And sometimes it's life-changing and you have no idea, you know, it's just kind of another door. It was a fluke even to get into acting as a kid. My parents had no connections, no interest in it, nothing. They were, you know, working class. We lived over by the Coliseum. But in those days, Fuller Brush salesmen, you know, and encyclopedia salesmen, everybody went door to door. And a guy came to our door signing kids up for tap dancing lessons or singing lessons or whatever at a place called the Meglin Studios, which was up on Venice near Arlington, I think. And it was Ethel Meglin and her sister had been in vaudeville. And when vaudeville died, they started this kind of weekend school just for regular kids. And I was already a show off at the age of 7 or whatever, you know, and my folks were talked into it. It was cheap enough. And so we took the bus every Saturday up to Meglin's and took tap dancing lessons. And for an extra 50 cents, you could sign up for the drama class taught by the tap dancing teacher's wife. So I signed
I
up.
Both of those facts. Then it was 50 cents. Then it was taught by the tap dancing.
Could have been a quarter. I mean, you know, it's a long time ago. And so every Monday night, the classes would kind of do a performance, whatever they were doing. And this one Monday night for the parents, there was a play done by the drama class called The Old Sleuth. And my job was to be the old sleuth's assistant, sit under a table and listen for clues. I didn't really even have any lines. And so when you're 8 years old, listening for clues requires that you make faces so everyone knows you're listening for clues. It was a serious play, but I got a lot of laughs and pretty much ruined the play. But Mrs. Meglin came up to my parents afterward and said, you know, this kid's funny. She's got interesting timing. Can she read? And my mom said, oh, yeah, she reads very well. So they said, would you be willing to send her on an interview for a radio series? They're looking, you know, for a kid who can actually read and express. So they said, gosh, I guess so. So we did. And, you know, the first time you go, there's 200 kids and then you go and there's 50 kids and then you go and there's just two of you. and you go to the old NBC studio on Sunset and Vine, which was a radio studio, and you read, it seemed to me like the middle of the night, and I got the part. So I got an agent. The agent sent me on an interview for the very early television series, Trouble with Father. I got that part, and I was an actor. And so that's honestly what I thought I would be. I mean, all the way up into college, when I went to UCLA, I was doing Dobie Gillis, Max Schulman, who wrote the book and many of the scripts for Dobie Gillis, was my proctor for exams because I couldn't go from the studio back to, but of course, all of the English professors knew him, so it was fine.
I've got to cut in and just let you know that among some of my friends, Max Schulman, this is true, was a favorite. And I don't even know if it was because of Dobie Gillis. I devoured Barefoot Boy with Cheek as a probably a high school senior or something. And it was only in preparing for this show, Sheila, that I found that it was written in 1943. I had no idea when I read it in, say, 63, 64, that it was 20 years old. It was so fresh to me about Yetta Samovar, the communist girl that our hero, I forget his name, it wasn't Dobie Gillis, I don't think. I think it was someone else, was pursuing and so on. And this notion to me as a young kid in high school in Florida of this world that he created made me probably as excited about college as anything I'd seen.
Well, when I went for my interview, I already knew the director and Dwayne Hickman because I had done the Bob Cummings show with them, just right. a kind of a one-off as a guest actor. And so they said, you should go across the street and talk to Max. So I walked in and I actually didn't see Max. He was not a very tall person and he was sitting in a huge chair and you could sort of see, you know, like the top of his head. And he said, say the first line that Zelda has. And I said, I love you. And he said, you're hired. And later when I asked him, he said, well, you're the only woman who came in that day who was shorter than I am. So
worked out for you.
And I guess he was kidding. But, you know, I learned so much. He was such a professional and a wonderful writer. And also the way he let us develop our own characters. Each of the women in the show had one chapter in The Many Loves of Dobie Gillis in the book.
Right.
But he brought Zelda back and wanted her to grow a little bit. I did four shows the first year. Then I was signed to a contract to be a regular. And he observed us. And he wrote the scripts in ways that expressed what we were expressing. You know, strength or grit or fear or silliness or whatever it was. And so it was so easy to play Zelda because she was really a lot of me.
And say just something about, because I know I've read some of your reminiscences looking back, and Zelda was pretty unusual for the time. And you said women would come up to you later and say that your portrayal of this character in the sitcom had really made a difference to them.
Well, it is interesting. And I think we know, but we don't quite appreciate how much the shows that we love really affect us.
Yes.
It's not just being a fangirl. It's really sort of seeing the possibilities. When you talk about, you know, how the world can be, one of the things that's so important is what we see and what we choose to see in the media. And there's so many choices now. It's much more difficult, but people still hone in on what they see. And it wasn't until the women's movement started, the second wave in the 70s, that I started hearing from women that I was the only woman allowed to be strong, allowed to be smart. Zelda was the smartest kid in the school. She tried everything from racing cars to running a record company. You know, I mean,
That's right.
Sort she of was craziness.
She just willing to do anything, fearless.
And tell Dobie what to do and how he would be, you know, it wasn't that she needed him to be successful the way Thalia Manager wanted him to be rich, but she wanted him to be everything he could be because, frankly, she could not. She could not be student body president.
Right.
No women were student body presidents in those days. As a matter of fact, the first woman student body president at UCLA was in 1972. And I was her advisor because I was working at UCLA by then. But the acting career really dried up when word got out, I think, that I was gay. I think word got out. But I had done a pilot for a series starring Zelda, and everybody was very high on it. But Jim Aubrey, who was then the president of CBS, killed it and said, "She's too butch. We can't go with this."
Now, when you said, by the
way, you know,
of course. But when you say that word had gotten out that you were gay, I don't think you'd come out at that point.
Oh, no. I thought deeply in the closet. But I was in a sorority at UCLA, and they kicked me out when they found some of my letters that I had left behind over a summer break that fell out the back of my dresser in the house from a woman who was my first partner who lived in San Diego. And they kicked me out when I came back to the sorority that fall. And it was devastating because that was my basis, not social basis, but friend basis. You know, I mean, and who would talk to me and who wouldn't talk to me after that was as it resonated even up until this century with who were my friends from college, you know.
Sure.
But that kind of dried up my acting career. But I loved UCLA, so I went back there for a job. And it happened to be in the mid-60s, and I guess you know what was happening in the mid-60s on college campuses.
I was in college from 65 to 69.
Well, I was in the campus programs and activities office at UCLA, acting as advisor to student organizations. And up until then, they had been pretty benign, but I was given to advise the Progressive Labor Party, the Student Liberation, I mean, the Women's Liberation Front, the SDS. You know, they didn't want any advice except how can we burn down the men's gym and not go to jail? And my advice was, if you want to do that, you will go to jail, but maybe that's part of the point. But I learned so much from them, and they're the ones that encouraged me to go to law school. So I applied to UCLA and I was turned down because when I went to college, it was Sputnik time and they were not giving out A's. They wanted to hone our skills. They wanted us to be the best we could be. So if somebody in a class got an A, we took them out for a beer. So my overall average was a 2.9, which is less than a B average. By the time I applied for law school, because of the Vietnam War, there had been grade inflation. And there was a study that showed all the grades went up almost a point. So my grades were way too low to get into UCLA. But my guardian angel, who I mean this literally, I think is my guardian angel, only appears, talk about those points in your life, came up to me on campus and said, you know, grade inflation, my study on grade inflation here at UCLA shows that your 2.9 is actually now a 3.75. Here's the study. Go apply to some other schools. So I did. And I got
armed with the study.
I sent it in with my application. I got into Harvard. I got into Bolt, Berkeley now. I was waitlisted at Yale and I was turned down again at UCLA because they didn't like this study. So my joke is UCLA turned me down. So I had to go to Harvard.
You know, I'll tell you two things. One, my son is there right now, Harvard, on a PhD program. And he'd gone in art history. He'd gone to Berkeley for his master's and wanted to go back to Berkeley. He got turned down at Berkeley and Harvard was his safe school. But the point I actually wanted to make was it was interesting to me when I read that you'd been turned down by UCLA and then went to Harvard Law, where you did very well. Let me just tell people you ended up chairing the celebration of the 25th anniversary of the first group of women to attend Harvard Law and only the second woman to win the moot court competition, which is a big deal at Harvard Law. But one of my favorite professors at Harvard in years just prior to this was Rogers Allbritton. I don't know if the name rings a bell or not, but he left his role as chair of the philosophy department at Harvard in 1972 to become chair of the philosophy department at UCLA. And the question was, well, why? His reason was Los Angeles was so much more of a welcoming environment. And he felt UCLA, too, would be more welcoming of an openly gay professor than Harvard.
Well, it is interesting. But, you know, California is like that and UCLA is like that as well. You know, they get more applications at UCLA than any other four-year university in the country.
So,
and it's not just because it's close to the beach. I mean, the excellence there is, it's astounding. And I don't say that just because they named me Alum of the Year last year. But it's sort of like the way people came to America to reinvent themselves. People also moved in America to the West to reinvent themselves.
Yeah, I saw the way you were nodding as I described his journey.
Yeah, well, it's not that it's just, you know, solidified and paralyzed in the East, but it was interesting to me going to law school and meeting people from really all over the world, but primarily from many other states in the nation, and really appreciating how California was sort of the dream state where you would go really to reinvent yourself. And there was never any question that I would stay back there and practice. I wanted to come home and practice. And I had been at UCLA. I became very interested in the women's movement. I wanted to come back and work on women's rights. And when I did come back, I tried corporate law for about 5 months. And that I don't say it's bad. It really wasn't for me. It was boring to me. So I worked in domestic violence issues, family law issues, things that affected women's lives. And that was one of those other things that sort of just changed your life. Because I decided, well, maybe I want to try and teach. And when I applied, I wasn't hired anywhere because I hadn't been, you know, winning moot court is one thing at Harvard, and it's good, especially when Thurgood Marshall is your lead judge. That was
not bad.
But, you know, I wasn't on Law Review. I hadn't even applied for Law Review. So at the last minute, Loyola Law School hired me to teach contracts to first year students. And that's kind of how I started working in the law, you know, for real. And I loved teaching the law. And that really led me to be testifying in Sacramento about domestic violence issues and women's issues. And, you know, when you sit in Sacramento and you watch people in those committees, you can't help but think, I could do this. I mean, especially since most of them weren't lawyers. So the thought began to grow that I would run, although my friends say that that's just BS because I was on the student council in high school, the student council in college, the president of my class in Harvard, you know, the council. I mean, I was always elected. But I never thought of doing it as a profession. I really didn't.
Yeah, I was going to ask what that moment was, what that itch was.
Well, when I really became so much clearer on the fact that making real change in society requires advocacy, it requires revolution, it requires a lot. But what it really requires is embedding things in the law. In America, because we actually are a country of laws. And it makes me very hopeful to think about that. And I thought the fulcrum for that for me was the state legislature, because that's where the laws are made about people's civil rights in the state, even better than the federal government. I mean, to be one of 440 didn't seem to me like being able to be effective that much, though Karen Bass did show us that that was not the case. So I decided to run in 94 for the state assembly. And that is how what people think of as my career, which is really kind of my sixth career, got started.
Yep. And I don't remember the person you succeeded in the assembly, Terry Friedman. But I do remember that in the Senate, you succeeded Tom Hayden and were succeeded by Fran Pavely. So that Senate district certainly has, you know, this wonderful history of progressive politics.
Well, it is interesting when you have when you represent a district that has your back, the way this district did and does. They elected the first gay person ever elected to the state legislature in California ever. From that district. And it was not just the West Side. It was the West Side of the Valley, too. And it was such a caring, lovely district. The Republicans at that time, and I think still, were sort of like your fathers and Republicans, if you had any in your family. you know, they were really concerned about the economy. They thought they were conservatives, but nothing compared to what they're calling conservatives now.
Right. And I agree with you, by the way, on the calling. In other words, because people need labels, they continue to call them conservatives. They're much more radical and regressive.
Yeah, they're not conserving anything but their own behinds.
That's
today.
Let me jump in for a second to tell you about an incident that I observed that sort of will put your 94 legislature in some context. Following Trump's Electoral College victory, which is the way I describe it, in 2016, I attended a large meeting of nonprofit leaders and community activists at the California Endowment, an outfit you are very familiar with. And people were pretty shell-shocked by the election and the prospects of the work ahead and so on. And a millennial Latina spoke towards the end of the event, and her words gave me hope. She shared that the last time she'd woken up that depressed, that shaken by an election, had been in 1994, when California had passed 287. People who don't know or don't remember, 287 as an anti-immigrant piece of legislation was outshone anything Trump did, I think. I mean, it was really draconian. And it was later thrown out by the courts. But what she said was, look back now where we are, California, in 2016. And she said, my hope is that just as we were ahead of the rest of the country in our anti-immigrant, we are ahead of the rest of the country in our progress. And, you know, and take hope from that we just are 20 years ahead, and, you know, the rest of the country will come to their senses too.
And you never know. I mean, the other thing that happened in 1994 in California in that election was that for the first time in 25 years, there was a Republican majority in the assembly.
Exactly.
Barely by, you know, one number. And that was the assembly that I went into. Newt Gingrich had his contract on America. He called it Contract for America, and it was a new kind of a Republican too. They brought their Bibles to the floor. One wore his Boy Scout uniform. Another wore Lederhosen. I mean, they were clowns, but dangerous clowns. And they tried to undo in the 2 years that they were in the majority. They tried to recall people so they could build a majority. They didn't succeed at that, but they tried very hard to unravel environmental laws, civil rights laws, everything. And in the last meeting of that 2 year session, they played Revolution by the Beatles as though they had, you know, done something. And I threw up my mic. It's a wonderful place for making speeches. I have to say, just run for office just for that. Threw up my mic and I said, you know, if you play that song backwards, do you remember when there was this mythology that if you play
Especially with the Beatles,
there were secret messages? So I said, if you play that song backwards, it says to you, watch out for 1996. And indeed, we took the House back in 96. And that's how I became Speaker Pro Tem, because it was a, you know, Democratic House. But it was very anti-gay on their side. A lot. I mean, if your followers want to look up a very good movie, actually, I think it's on YouTube. It's called Political Animals. And it's about the 5 years that it took me and then Carol Migdon, Chris Kehoe, Jackie Goldberg to pass the first bill that barred discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. And it has a lot of speeches on the floor by the clowns on one side, a lot of emotion. I think people will be surprised at how personal and emotional politics is, but maybe not now that we can watch Jamie Raskin and other people, you know, Elizabeth. And you can see it's very personal, very strong, and very important to individual people, what the government does.
Yeah. And you know, one could look again, as I sort of said, that look at California relative to the country, that the overreach of that slim majority sent them back to the back. And they have, I mean, now, you know, we have Democratic supermajorities. There's seldom a state office holder from the Republican Party, even though our Republican Party is not as crazy as the National Republican Party. Let me tell people that you're listening to a Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking today with Sheila Kuehl, California legislator for 12 years, LA County supervisor for 8, and out of office for a little more than 3 months. And we're looking back at that long and influential career. And really, as your, I really sense your experience of that career as much as, you know, the signposts or the laws and so on. What was your experience like in the legislature? You've said, and it's certain, I mean, oh, and let me put it this way. I watched you and thought you were effective. You were like in the dictionary as a picture of effective legislator. If you agree with that, what was your experience like and why were you effective?
Well, let me take both sides of that question. My experience, I had no idea what to expect. I have always thought in my life that other people knew more about something I was getting into than I did. There were no lawyers in my family. I didn't know what it would be like to go to law school. There were no, or to be a lawyer, or, you know, it's not that I was so important doing things first in my family. It's just that I didn't know and other people did, I thought. So I thought these people knew how to be legislators too, but they don't. I mean, some of them, there's no way to know what it's like until you're in it. And that's why legislators on both sides of the aisle are still kind of close friends in a weird way. Not the horrible people that cut ties. But Jim Brulte, when the sheriff came and raided my house, was one of the first people to text me, "Are you okay?" Jim Brulte, for your followers, was the Republican leader in the Senate. He thought he would be speaker, but Willie Brown could have tricked him out of it in the assembly. But Jim was a major leader and is still a friend. What you go through is just almost inexplicable in getting a law through. It's not just your colleagues. It's all the people who come and testify for it and against it, people who are relying on you. I loved it. I have to say, I loved it, even though it was really hard. After I left the Senate, I slept 11 hours a day for a month.
Wow.
I didn't know I was sleep deprived or that tired or whatever. It uses you up in such a really good way. Also,
well, especially if you're as active and involved as you were. I mean, I have 171. I was shocked when I saw that number. 171 sponsored bills passed.
Not just passed, but signed into law by three different governors.
Yes, right. You know? Yeah, because we know some of your favorites were vetoed.
Yes. Well, 300 bills didn't get through. So, you know, I mean, you get to do 50 every session. So it's, you can actually make a big dent in a lot of areas that you want to be part of. The environment, people's rights, education, social services, housing, everything.
So I've already thought of my next one, but that second part of the last one, which is why were you effective? And are there principles, strategies, and things that are teachable?
I really think so. I mean, some of it, I think, is everything I need to know I learned in kindergarten, you know, that book, which is, I think, so right. When you're far apart from someone and you want to get them to be with you, you have to appreciate where they are. You can't just stand on your side of the bridge and go, okay, you cross the bridge to where I am. I'm not talking compromise. I'm talking understanding and respect. There were Republicans I was never going to get. I mean, there wasn't one that voted ever for a bill to help gay people. There were some Democrats who were afraid that they would lose their seat, and it was hard to get their vote. That's why it took us 5 years. But what I have always believed is you have a strong presence, you have a strong point of view, you explain things so that other people can understand them, not your own jargon or whatever, but where are they? Not talking down to them, just what are they interested in? What do they want to accomplish? Honest to God, most people ran for office to try to do good for somebody.
Yeah.
So, you know, if I had to say to people, you know, protecting people at work is from being fired for bad reasons is actually good for business, because think about your training costs. If you're going to just let employees be fired because they have their wedding picture with another guy on their desk, but they're the best one in your sales department, who's the loser? Both of you. So, you know, you just, it wasn't a lie. It was simply wanting people to think why these things made sense for them as well. The second
let
thing
me
is,
jump in quickly. If you actually are talking with someone, which a lot of it is that, talking with someone, and you think there's a chance they'll come to your side, then to go about it any other way than the way you described makes no sense. You know, that if there's a, you must have an inkling that there's some place where you overlap, and what you want to do is find that place.
There's also respect, as I mentioned, and humor. It's got to be funny. There was a guy who was so anti-gay. He had given a long, long, very famous speech outlining, I thought with a little too much enjoyment, the sexual practices of gay men.
Oh, yes.
And so when I got to the assembly, he was still in the assembly, a Republican. So I went over to him and I said, hi, I'm Sheila. And I put out my hand, and reflexively, he would shake my hand. And I said, and the good news is it's not catching. And he just laughed. I mean, he couldn't help himself. So we actually co-authored a bill together later that was to protect foster kids.
Great.
You know, I'm not saying I was always successful, but I knew what I wanted. I think being a lawyer really helped, because I could look at the language that was suggested by the office that writes bill language. And I would say, this doesn't quite get there. We need simpler language. Simpler language, one paragraph, not six. Because the law should be simple and easy to understand, so you can obey it. And
let me jump to something. Sure. I read in one of the articles I read recently that I think it was Janice Hahn, it might have been Stephanie Barger, who said that you used to talk to her before she proposed something that you knew she was going to propose, to really go through it, like bit by bit. And she said, as tough as that was, it was always helpful. But that's a little bit of what you're saying here that you did with that legislative office, right?
Yes, except, you know, Janice, I mean, it's interesting because we don't really talk to each other. It's our staffs that talk to each other. And so she would get feedback that I thought, 60 days was too long. People should report back in 30 days or something like that through our staff. But she felt I was the only one who my staff would say, the supervisor says, la, la, la. So she's always been very generous about thinking I'm wonderful. So I think she's wonderful too. And I won't disabuse her of anything good she thinks about me.
Let me ask you something about the timing. In other words, I already set up that 94, the year you enter the legislature, is sort of the low point of California in terms of 287 and Republican majority. It looks like we're further to the right than much of the country at that point. That's the middle of the Clinton administration. You obviously contributed to both the state legislature and the county supervisor's office becoming more progressive, passing more progressive legislation, but also the state seemed to move. I'm sure you've looked at this. What is it about California other than, or probably including, some of what we mentioned when we were talking about why people move here and why people come back, that there is kind of a, you can reinvent yourself, the state can reinvent itself, our culture can reinvent itself. What is it about, I mean, when you think about how you were able to be effective and progressive in a state and then a county that was moving in the same direction as you, what was going on there?
Well, I think when people make a decision, a big decision to move, to come to California, for instance, they do it a lot out of hope. They hope that things will be better. I don't know whether that means that our population here in the West is more hopeful in many ways, but I do know that there are two big driving forces in politics, and they're opposed to each other, and you know them very well, hope and fear. My prejudice is that the Republican Party uses fear primarily, fear of the other, fear of what you're going to lose, fear that you'll be irrelevant, fear that other people are taking over your schools, fear, fear, fear. And on the blue side, I think we certainly have our fears as well, but I do think there's more hope in it. And that hope, when you have a Democratic majority, especially a supermajority, is much more likely to be enacted. It shows faith in people. For instance, in the county, when we decided to do a basic subsistence for 1,000 people, it reflected a study that showed that if you just could get ahead of your debts or, you know, not worrying about paying for groceries every weekend, you could actually do good work, you could seek better work, you could improve the lives of your family. So we voted to give a basic income to 1,000 families. Now, in the county of 10 million, you'd say it's nothing. But it is, as my predecessor, Zev Yaroslavsky, said, if you want to do a revolution, start out with a pilot. And so it was a pilot project. But that reflects hope. That reflects faith that people will take the money and grow it and grow their lives so that they won't need it after a while. Right. And it goes to
grow their sense of possibility.
Right. And so that, I think that faith is expressed in ways in the law where we believe that people will do well. While all the Republicans were talking about welfare mothers and how lazy they were, we knew that they were working single mothers. We knew them. We had grown up with them, many of us. And it was easier to put, it's not going to make sense to a lot of people, but to express hope in the law.
Yeah. It's interesting that you link those two, because I don't think people do much of the time. Hope seems soft and law seems hard somehow. And yet it's the.
Well, and you know, who would have thought we would have gay marriage? I mean, those of us in the old days, never. But in saying it's simply love, as Holly Near wrote in her song, it made sense to a lot of people who, just like those of us who are white during the civil rights movement, we had to take our prejudices out of our pockets and look at them. And that, I think, is what straight people did with the help of a lot of our straight allies, saying, look, do you know why they can't marry? It has nothing to do with being bad. It's because you keep people from having rights if you keep them from marrying, and that gives us more rights. Is that how you want to get your rights? On the backs of other people? And it made sense to a lot of people, because I'm, many people who have been through really horrible times, I think people are basically good, and you can call it out of them just by trying and treating them with respect.
That's right. And I mean, I would venture even that even to those who spend a lot of time in fear, in anger, in rage, in otherness, hope and goodness feel better. They may not be stimulated as easily, but they feel better at a deep, deep level. You made the point, and I had kind of intuited it, though I hadn't read it, that you worked on the state level, and now some would say you've had a very successful legislative career, go national, and instead you went even more local to the county supervisor, although as people know, very few senators represent as many people as LA County supervisors do. It's pretty wild. But Washington seems so much more damaged than than California to me. I find the people who get elected because of our primary system and the way that that sort of feeds the bases are more extreme, more partisan than either people who work at the state level in government or certainly than their constituents. Can you talk just a little bit about how Washington looks to you as someone who has labored in the trenches to get good things passed?
Well, I think it's easy to bash the people in Washington, but if you look at people, most of the obvious people who are kind of on TV all the time on our side or on, you know, the others who actually took the assembly seat that I had after Fran Pavley had it and moved to Ventura County and is representing, you know, kind of a purple area, working very hard for veterans. And people don't know, when things got better for veterans, it was Julia that brought the bill. And, you know, you just look around in various states and you can see just a lot of people trying to do good for people. They don't get the headlines, but when there's over 400 of them in the House, you know, there's a lot of them doing that. So I think that the media is so enamored of war that they pretty much characterize everything as a war. You know what they say about when your only tool is a hammer, you know,
everything you see is a nail. Yeah. Or all you can see is nails.
Yeah. And so I see dysfunction in Washington. Well, Trump upended so much that needs to be repaired and still hasn't. That was such a surprise to the country because we take for granted that people in both parties will want to be a good president in the sort of lax but still somewhat present rules, like the Bushes, you know, I mean, or Nixon. And we've thought, oh, terrible, terrible, you know, but they had a sense of government and governing. Although with Bush Jr., it was more like Cheney had a sense of governing. But then all the rules went right out the window with this guy who should have never been in office. And we're recovering from that, I think. The other thing is the election and permission given to people in the Republican Party who are very extreme to simply lie and say whatever they like. And, you know, no one ever says my esteemed colleague anymore or whatever. There are certain rituals that should be kept to because it causes you, whether it's phony or not, to be your best self, you know. And that is what has been lost. And in some of the state houses, too. I mean, Florida is a mess. Texas is a mess. Michigan, I can't.
And those, by the way, are what, two of the four most populous states? I think it's California, New York, Texas, Florida.
Right. But if you look at the percent of people voting.
I know.
I mean, we think we're bad. And that's
one of the things, by the way, let me jump in for just a second. But I think one of the things that two different people I've interviewed over the last year or so. One was Rebecca Henderson, who teaches at the Harvard Business School. Branko Milanovic, an economist, you know, very different approaches. They both pointed out a critical place where capitalism fails. And they said capitalism fails when the corporations get to write their own rules. That up until that point, it's a kind of a fair game, you know, but because of Citizens United and because of the Powell memo, which people who listen to the show all the time, I won't go into, but they know what I'm talking about. At this point, corporations do write their own rules. And that's when a system which has its own sort of rhythms and things has broken down. And I think that's what gives us the Washington that we have at this point.
Well, the other thing is, I think people think that you get bought by people contributing to your campaign. And it's true in some cases and not true in most cases. when you start a campaign, you go to your family, you go to your friends, you go to people you went to elementary school with, you raise money from everybody you can, because God bless the child who's got her own, as the song goes. And that is what a lot of people do, and they are not beholden to one thing or another. But some people who don't know why the hell they want to run for office, they just want to be in office, they think they don't know how to raise money. They never worked in a nonprofit. You know, they just don't know. So they feel like they need to do what their contributors, the corporations, ask them to do. And of course, they're already halfway there because they think that business has saved America or whatever the hell. But the two, I think, most difficult diseases that the country is facing and has faced is greed and guns. I could talk about prejudice and racism, and that I think everybody's now, oh yeah, I think we understand that. But greed, we don't really embrace the notion that people just want more and more and more and more. And if you've got it, I don't have it, so I need to have it, and you can't have it. And the same thing with guns. I mean, the Second Amendment never, never was meant to protect these kinds of guns, ever. And they're, you know, originalists in every other part of the Constitution except the Second Amendment. But I digress. And I see, I think that we have relied on unions for a lot of decades to sort of even it up for the working person. And indeed, they have done a great deal. But it can't be the only thing, because they are so much for themselves as well, that they can't really solve it for all of us. And that's why I really like the grassroots political organizing that's been going on all over the country. Sister District and, you know, all of the different sort of really local groups.
Yes, yes. That down ballot sort of stuff.
To really look at their Congress people, who's running, what are they going to do, and really look at them not only in terms of their own individuality, but in terms of what they can add to a majority, and thinking about the larger idea that you must have a majority in order to enact the kind of laws that people elect you, hoping that you will. You can't do it without a majority.
Okay, we've got about five or six minutes left. What's next for you? Are you working on a book? What are you working on?
You know, I have always wanted to write my autobiography. And I read a wonderful biography called The Entertainer. It was about Lyle Talbot, the actor, written by his daughter, who writes for The New Yorker.
Really, I had, by the way, Margaret and David on to talk about their book about the 60s, right?
Right.
And we talked about Lyle Talbot and
his book. The thing that struck me about that book is that every part of his life was centered in the history of the time in this book, because his changes in what kind of an entertainer he was absolutely reflected the changes in how we got our entertainment from the beginning of the 20th century up until almost the end. And I thought, you know, that's the kind of autobiography I want to write, and I don't think anyone else can do it. But in these 3 months, I've been doing much more mundane work. I had to move out of my office, and I have 30 years of stuff. And it's not the kind of stuff that goes into the archive. I'm not talking official stuff. I'm talking 150 books that I just collected and kept in my office instead of at home. I'm not bragging, but 350 awards that there's no room for anywhere. So I made an arrangement with an award store to take them there, maybe 20 at a time, so they can recycle them, maybe make new awards out of them for Girl Scout troops, I don't know what. And I'm going to a frame store and taking all the framed stuff that, you know, if they can use the frames. So there's a lot of honing and winnowing and, I guess, purging, one would say, to get that all done. And that will probably be done by the end of next month, which would be the end of April. But I'm thinking a lot about the book. And I want to do a book that really encompasses all the various stages of my life and the things that, you know, I went through, lodged a little bit in the history of the time, which I didn't always know. I was in the first film television series in 1950. Everything was live before then. And it was because the studios thought that TV was going to put them out of business, which, of course, we're looking at again, right? And so Hal Roach and his son had this wonderful idea. Why don't we film things for television? So that was the Stu Irwin Show, or Trouble with Father, as it was called. And I want to know more about that. I want to know more about my mother's relatives who came out of Ukraine and through Poland, which is another similarity. You know, what was the war? What were pogroms? What were all the things we heard about? How did my dad's family get here from Germany? German Catholic, Russian Jew. We never discussed religion at dinner, I can tell you that. But it was fine. They were fine. So I want to know more about my life.
So and then one thing that I hear you saying is writing an autobiography, the way you're looking towards it, is actually learning a lot, not just telling what you already know, but learning a lot that you don't know about what created.
Although I have to say, Terrence, my working title for it is My Life as I Remember It, probably a novel. I'm sure you might experience the same issue with memory. I see the color of your hair.
Yes.
I mean, and then someone will say, that's not how it happened.
I know, that is so funny when I have these wonderful incidents, right? And I relate them, and then I will often my own self go, wait, did that actually happen? Or did that happen to me? Or was I right?
I know we expropriate a lot of stories and don't realize it.
Yep.
And also memory tends to harden as we tell the same stories over and over. And I no longer know exactly what was said, but I know what I say was said in my story.
Right.
I think it was true to begin with. But right. Anyway, I just want to know more before I kind of commit pen to paper, as they
say. Sure. One book I'll recommend to you, because I interviewed the author on it, is called The 50s.
Okay.
By James Gaines. When someone asked me recently, what was your most interesting interview recently? That's the one I said. His kids were studying the 60s. And he said, you know, where'd the 60s come from? And the book, The 50s, is about the individuals like Pauli Murray or Harry Hay. Mm-hmm. Or Medgar Evers, who there were no movements,
right?
For what they were fighting for. And so, and since you're in that age group where you were kind of, you know, the 50s were a little earlier for me than they were for you. I think it might be interesting in terms of the history.
Well, and even if I was a pebble on the brook, you know, just being swept along, which I'm sure I was at least in the early times. But I, you know, I've led a fortunate life, and I'm filled with gratitudes these days. I mean, I love retirement. I haven't been this happy since I'm 6 years old. You wake up in the morning and you say, what do I feel like doing today? And if somebody says, I think you should do this. I mean, this is the only interview I'm giving. Everybody wants me to tell my life story to people. And I'm thinking, I don't know why I would do that. I mean, it's for them to have a chapter somewhere. I'm going to have the chapter instead.
Well, thank you. Thank you, by the way. I had hope when I reached out to you that, you know, we'd done it before. But then when I realized that it had only been 3 months, I thought, this is probably a rare opportunity.
Well, I mean, everybody wants to talk to a guy that thinks there's some way to make the world work.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Yeah. Okay, we got to bring it to a close. I've been speaking, as you see, with Sheila Kuehl, the longtime public servant as a California legislator and an LA County supervisor. Thank you, Sheila Kuehl. Keep up the good work.
My pleasure. Good to talk with you.
For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements on who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually links to 10 articles to kind of flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally, temcnally, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on most podcast sites, Apple Podcasts, all the big ones, and so on. You'll find years of podcasts there. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence, McNallyTerence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos of Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Sheila, it's been a pleasure.